You are looking live at Chicken Dinner.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
I think I'll take two chickens.
Go on riverboat gambling trips.
You're going to die for some chickens.
Hey, what's your chicken dinner?
Someone is.
It was feathers yesterday. There was no chicken.
What you got riding on this game?
My daughter.
What a gambler.
It's Chicken Dinner.
Hey, Babalugas, we got a bet here.
Here's your host, Sam Panionovich.
It's called Winner, Winner, Chicken Dinner right there, boys.
Let's get this thing going.
Winner, Winner, Chicken Dinner. How about that?
Away we go. Chicken Dinner Wednesday, June 16th, 2021. Follow us on Twitter at ChickenXDinner, Instagram at ChickenDinnerSP, and subscribe to the podcast. Smash the button so when the podcast drops, it slides onto your phone. You get that push notification, and you can listen as you please. We will talk to Rob Pizzola, who's a very good sports bettor and a partner at BetStamp. How do you quantify something that can't really be quantified? I've talked to Rob for years now about quantifying this and quantifying that, and there's something right now in sports that has never been quantified before, and it's essentially a guessing game. So we'll talk about things like that with Rob Pizzola. Also, how do you handle bad runs and learn from your losses? I have had a couple of those stretches over the last 6 months, actually even less than that. Had a bad stretch in March and a bad stretch in May. And here's Sammy Buckets again, winner on the Nets, +3.5. But it's not about gloating about your wins all the time. It's learning from your losses. Why did I lose this game? And how does the result affect the way that I handicap a similar situation in the future? If I make a pick on a basketball team catching 5.5 points and they get drilled by 30, what did I do wrong? I would argue a bad beat is not a bad bet. You take a football team, you're laying 7, they're up by 21 at halftime, and they win by 6. Did I really do anything wrong? I would argue no. I would argue there was some variance there and some tough luck there, but there's a difference between a good loss and a bad loss. I love talking to Pizzola. The interview actually went 31 minutes long. I trimmed it to about 28. We could have gone for an hour. Rob has a lot of thoughts, and he's a very, very sharp cat. I couldn't get the show up on Tuesday. You know, we usually do Tuesday and Thursday. Yesterday was one of those days. I spent about 4 hours in total on content that was based around James Harden not playing for the Nets in Game 5 because nobody had him playing. At least when I went to bed Monday night, woke up Tuesday morning, he wasn't even listed on the injury report. And then all of a sudden, it's like, well, wait a minute, he's doubtful. Now he's questionable. I wrote about 1,200 words for Fox. I talked to Jeff Sherman at the Westgate, and we did a story, which I had to pretty much delete more than half of and rewrite it, about how the books tinker with everything after the Kyrie Irving injury. Remember, game one, Nets are at full strength. They're a 3.5-point favorite or a 4-point favorite at home against the Milwaukee Bucks. Harden gets hurt in the first minute of game one. Bucks become a short favorite on the road in game two. And in game four in Milwaukee, Kyrie gets hurt, busts his ankle, and the market just... So there was a lot of conversation to be had from Jump Street. This is something that doesn't just affect the Game 5 line, which opened Milwaukee -2.5. Some books opened 3 to get ahead of the move. It got to 4, and then you're just watching Twitter and seeing Woj bombs. James Harden, going to try and give it a go. James Harden, going to test it at shoot-around. James Harden, probably going to play. And the 4s turned into 3.5s, turned into 3s. And by the time the game started, Milwaukee was -1. And you could argue Milwaukee probably should have won that game. It took 49, 17, and 10 from Durant to bring it home. Harden wasn't even that good. My one buddy said he looked flat. I said, flat or fat? He said both. Harden, give Harden credit for playing, because when Harden's on the floor, even if he's not at 100%, which he isn't, he's a decoy. Or he's still a distributor, still passing the ball around the floor. And when Harden's on the floor, it allows other pieces to go where they belong. So Sherman told me that without Irving and without Harden, he thought those two together are worth 8 points or more to the point spread. Thing is, you can't exactly adjust it. You can't make Milwaukee minus six in Brooklyn, because then you're going to have arbitrage guys, the number guys, come in, and they're going to take a great number in their mind. So they're going to take six, down to 5.5, down to five. So Sherman, on Sunday night with his crew at the Westgate in the back, he said, look, I'm going to open Milwaukee 3. The market opened 2.5, and as we said, it got up to 4. So that affects the Game 5 market. You don't know if Harden's going to play. You know Irving's out. You're on the fence on Harden, but you're leaning no. All of a sudden, he's in, and that changes the point spread and crashes it down. It also, the uncertainty, I guess, with James Harden and Kyrie Irving affected the series price drastically. Remember, the Nets won the first two games. So who would have thought that after Game 4, the Bucks would be a series favorite, because Games 5 and Game 7 are in Brooklyn. It's not possible in most situations. Thing is, as we've learned over the last 2 weeks or so, a crucial injury to a superstar player can change everything. The Lakers, they win Game 3. All of a sudden, they're a $9 favorite. Minus 900. You got to lay 9 to win 1 against Phoenix. They lose Game 4, and most importantly, they lose Anthony Davis. After Game 4, the Suns are minus 150, minus 160 to win the series. We haven't seen swings like that. And there are a lot of factors that go into a series price. So we saw Brooklyn go from a pretty big favorite after Game 2 to the underdog heading into Game 5 at home, where they're catching points on their own floor. Sherman was also explaining, and this is, of course, before Harden gets cleared and put into play, even though the Bucks had better odds or a better chance mathematically to advance in the series, the Brooklyn Nets still had better odds to win the East and to win the title. Wait, what? If you weren't confused yet, now you're fucking scratching your head. You don't know what's going on. Well, because it's all the liability. All the Nets bets that have been made on Brooklyn from before the season into January when they acquire Harden, and those odds were as high as 10, 12 to 1 to win the title, people were betting the Nets nonstop. So the books at that point, yeah, they're trying to brace for all this Milwaukee series action, but still they have to protect themselves from raising the odds on the Nets too high. And you also think about playing it forward. Okay, Harden's probably going to give it a go. If not in Game 6, he'll play in Game 7. And if they win the series, it gives Brooklyn more time to nurse Kyrie Irving back to full strength, or close to full strength, or whatever. Who knows who's full strength? I'm not even full strength. Imagine being a bookmaker. This is just insane calculus, because it affects so many different markets. An injury to not only one but two superstars affects the game in a different way than it does the series, than it does the futures. It's different for all three. And there's a lot of juggling going on behind the scenes. Now, the piece that went up for Fox, I even wrote in there, and I tweeted this out. We know I had the Nets plus 3.5. I was trying to grab a good number that I didn't think was going to be available. But also what I discussed in that story, I wrote, quote, I don't hate a position on Brooklyn plus 135 to win the series right now. The story continues, if Kevin Durant goes off tonight and Harden plays meaningful minutes, the Nets could easily win at home as a dog, and all of a sudden they're the favorite again. Now, I wrote Brooklyn could go from plus 135 to minus 200 or so, considering they'll host Game 7 and maybe Irving can play, but we're all guessing at this point. It's a guessing game. That's the other thing, too. I got a bunch of direct messages yesterday. What do you know about Harden? I don't know shit. How do you think he's going to play? I have no idea. I'm grabbing a number because I know by tip-off, 3.5 won't be available. But this NBA postseason has been drastically shaped by injuries. I would have loved to have seen the Denver Nuggets at full strength with Jamal Murray. The Lakers at full strength with Anthony Davis. The Nets, will we ever see them at full strength in the postseason with Durant and Irving and Harden? And now you got Chris Paul. He's got COVID. Kawhi Leonard's got a knee injury. It's like, holy shit. I don't envy the bookmakers in this NBA postseason. That's for sure. Speaking of the NBA playoffs, they have taken the Trae Young angle off the board at DraftKings and FanDuel. We did this in Game 3. We did it in Game 4, playing Trae Young to be the leading scorer in the game. It was plus 230 in Game 3. It was plus 190 in Game 4. And it is off the board at most books. I don't know that maybe we just peppered them well enough. I don't think that's the case. Maybe they're scared. But this is not offered, at least at the time of taping, around noon Eastern on Wednesday. You can't bet this at DraftKings or FanDuel. I had one listener send in a message and say, hey, it's live on PointsBet. But here's what the market has done in just two games. Young was plus 230 to lead the game in scoring in three, plus 190 in four, as we've said. PointsBet has plus 160 in game five. It's not even that I liked it. I hate not backing something that's two for two, even though it's probably due to lose, given the math. Here's the thing with Trae Young. It's about opportunity and volume. And when you look at his game log and his shot chart, the guy is going to get his as far as attempts. I like him tonight in game five. I like his point total over 27.5, flat, minus 10. And I like him over 2.5 threes, minus 130. PointsBet's got minus 20. MGM's got minus 30. One book had minus 38. One book had 40. Just give it in the middle. It's easier for everybody. Over 2.5 threes, minus 30. The last game against Philly, Trae Young was 8 for 26 from the floor and 3 of 11 from 3. Those aren't even close to his averages as far as percentage goes. You look at game 1, 11 of 23 from the floor. Game 2, 6 of 16. Game 3, 9 of 17. Game 4, 8 of 26. So if he shoots on average from a percentage standpoint, he's going to have a chance to get over not only 2.5 threes, but 27.5 points. And I'm guessing the Sixers are going to be up in this game. That market has moved quite a bit. Philly opened 6.5. Actually, one book had 6 on the Global Open. 6.5s and a lot of 7s now in the market. This is a bad situation, I feel like, for Atlanta. They got blitzed in Game 3 at home. They should have lost in Game 4, but they had a great comeback late. I worry about their ability to score inside in the game as a team. They take a lot of jump shots. They got a lot of guys that shoot a lot of long shots. I don't know that I like the whole team, but I like the avenue for Trae Young to get buckets and to shoot a lot of shots. So that's what we're doing tonight. Over 27.5 points, over 2.5 threes. I mean, he just takes so many threes in this round alone. 11 in game 1, 7 in game 2, 6 in game 3, 11 in game 4. Make 3, and we're a winner. I think there's a really good chance you go 2 for 2 there with those props. I don't know that he leads the game in scoring. I don't really feel that strongly about it, and we can't really bet it because everybody's scared to take it. Let's just do Young to get his tonight. I really wanted to talk about this going into this series, but the series started on Monday in the National Hockey League. Montreal and Vegas, the Habs and the Golden Knights. I could not believe the series price. Some books in Vegas had the Knights minus 510 to win the series. That's before the puck even drops. That is so ridiculous and so high and so over-adjusted. I texted with a couple bookmakers in Vegas. One of them said the Knights should be minus $3. The other one said the Knights should be minus $350. So, in a roundabout way, the market being minus $5 before game one is a $1.50 or a $2 over adjustment. And here's why. There's a couple reasons. Number one, Vegas has home ice and Montreal doesn't. Full capacity in Las Vegas. And last time I checked, 3,000 fans in Montreal. That's number one. Number two, Vegas bettors are going to bet Vegas, and they have since the team started. When they bet them from 500 and 300 to 1 in their first season to every game since with the money line parlays and the puck lines, all that stuff. There's a lot of money that comes into Vegas on the Golden Knights. So there's a tax that Vegas bookmakers have to put on the Golden Knights. And number three, it's the way that they eliminated Colorado. Remember, Colorado wins the first two games. They're a $9 favorite after game two. Vegas wins four in a row. Were they the better team? I don't know. But they blitzed the sexy team in a lot of people's postseason projections. A lot of people I know had Colorado in the Cup final. I did too. I had Colorado and Boston. In fact, I had three futures in the NHL. Colorado, Carolina, Boston. All alive and then all dead in the same round. Boom, boom, boom. But the way that Vegas dispatched Colorado, all of a sudden, wow, maybe Vegas is the best team in the league. And they very well could be. But all of those factors go into the blender, and when you calculate it, it creates a price that is too high. Well, yeah, good call. The Knights won game one. Well, yeah, they're expected to, and that's built into the price. Have you seen the price now? At one book in Vegas, the Vegas Golden Knights with a 1-0 lead are minus 1,100 to advance. That is over 90% chance of probability. I don't think that's accurate. Habs win game two. All of a sudden, we got a series. We'll see what happens in game number two. I'm not going to play the Habs straight. We do have the series. We tweeted that out at plus 400. It's a number grab. Got a lot of people, well, you know, Vegas is going to win the series. Yeah, probably. The math says yes. But there's too much variance in hockey and too much random shit that goes on and a lot of puck bounces and puck luck. My argument is simple. If I think a team should be plus 250 and I get 425, I'm taking it. End of story. Couple more things before we get to Rob Pizzola. I have a couple thoughts on the U.S. Open. The first one is more reactionary to this report from David Purdom. He talked to Jeff Sherman on Monday. Sherman told Purdom, more bets have been placed on Phil Mickelson to win the U.S. Open than any other golfer at the Superbook. This guy, Mickelson, come on. Really? You think he's winning the U.S. Open? I'm thinking, let's fade this. Let's fade lefty. I found plus 120 on Mickelson to miss the cut. Do I have advanced analytics? Do I have anything to back it up? No, I just want to fade. I just want to see the world burn sometimes. Mickelson. Before the last major he won at age 50, he was, I think, minus 200 to miss the cut. Now he's the favorite to make the cut. We overreact to what we've last seen. And him buzzing around the course, winning that major, awesome story. Does it mean he's going to cut it at Torrey Pines? No. So I think you can build into that and go against Mickelson. Maybe he doesn't miss the cut. I just, like I said, I'm extremist here on this one. Everybody's betting him to win. I want to play him to miss the cut. But that is a guy, Phil Mickelson, you may be able to key against in the head-to-head matchups. I'd be careful putting my money on Mickelson to repeat history. I'm skeptical. A lot of guys I respect, ironically enough, are on the two golfers that hate each other, Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau. I was talking to a couple guys, James Mazzola agrees, a couple other guys that bet golf for a living, they like DeChambeau, they like Koepka. Mazzola also has a pop on Patrick Reed at 44 to 1. So those are the three names being floated my way. Again, I have no skin in the game on this one. I'm not a big golf bettor myself, and I definitely don't play stuff for the show. But those are the names I'm hearing. Koepka, DeChambeau, and Reed. Take that for what it's worth. My favorite angle is fading lefty at this point in time. And last thing, I saw this over the weekend. I don't have the Barstool Sportsbook, but I downloaded the app a week ago. I've probably got 12 different apps, and I just never got around to downloading the Barstool Sportsbook. Well, I did, and they have this bet. I didn't know about this, and this was an amazing tip. They have a bet called the Big Yabo. It is a weekend-long prop, Saturday and Sunday, with a total for home runs hit on both Saturday and Sunday. And the Big Yabo last weekend, the over-under was 67.5. This is a bet where there's no science. You are just firing. And that's what Barstool Sportsbook wants you to do. They want you to fire. They want you to bet with their personalities. They want you to join the Overs Club. They want you to do this and do that. And look, that's fine. If you're into it, go for it. I would not be betting the Big Yabo because I don't feel like I have an edge. That being said, I'm sure there are a lot of people that do bet the Big Yabo. And I'd probably say that more people bet the over than the under. What do you know? With a total of 67.5 home runs, the over hit on Sunday Night Baseball. You got the 68th homer to go over the Big Yabo on Sunday night. That is a sweat. If you're a sweater and you like those, hey, good for you. Not my cup of tea anymore, but I think that's pretty cool. We could bet on the Big Yabo. You could bet on total home runs for Saturday and Sunday. Oof. God bless you. Joining us on Chicken Dinner, he is Rob Pozzola. He's a sports bettor, but some things have changed since the last time he joined us on the show. Now a partner at BetStamp and the co-host of the Circles Off podcast. I have to say, I think I'm more surprised that you started your own podcast than I am about you joining BetStamp.
It's kind of weird, but I've always craved the media side of things. Like I started in the sports media in Canada straight out of university. So when I kind of moved on into being a professional bettor and leaving that stuff behind, I've always had the itch to do it. And I think the podcast really fills that void for me. So I've enjoyed doing it quite a bit. And in fact, it's given me the itch to do even more, if you can believe it. But it's always been something that's been true to my heart.
I definitely want to touch on BetStamp a little bit later on in this interview, but let's start with the conversation about the National Hockey League. Full disclosure, we tape this interview on a Monday. The show drops on a Tuesday, so we're sort of past posting a little bit. I had to take a pop. I made a call to Vegas and had a buddy go hit plus 425 on the series price for Montreal. I just think the price is so drastically over-adjusted. The fact that there's minus $5 and minus 510 on the Vegas team, which, yeah, they're good. I could argue they're pretty damn good. But there's so much variance in hockey and so many random bounces and puck luck and all that. I can't wrap my hands around a hockey team being minus 500 in a Stanley Cup playoff series.
Yeah, I completely agree with you from that point of view. I mean, I'm not in love with the matchup for the Montreal Canadiens just in general. I do largely believe in, I guess, them playing in an easier division this year and looking a lot better than they are. And I think this is really a real test for them. But I completely agree with your point on the variance in hockey. And sometimes you just kind of have to ignore that stuff and understand that Montreal can get badly outplayed for six or seven games and still win the series. And in fact, when we look at the Stanley Cup playoffs so far this season, we've had a lot of series so far where the better team has not won. And that's just something that you deal with, not only in hockey, but in other professional sports just in general. And when you're getting into these price ranges here, especially ones in Vegas that are obviously, adjusted based off of the clientele, which is mostly going to be looking to bet Vegas, you can find some value from that side of things. So yeah, do I think Montreal is going to win the series? No, I don't. When you're looking at prices of plus 400 or higher, yeah, I think they're worth a shot at that price range. And I don't expect them to be better than Vegas for the majority of this series, but they have Carey Price in net, who was very average for the last couple years in the NHL, but is clearly playing very well right now. And that gives them a chance to steal any sort of game. I'm in agreement with you, Sam, there. I think you got a good price on the Habs.
As long as I've known you, Rob, you have always tried to quantify. You're trying to put a number on something. We're in a situation, I don't want to get hyperbolic, but we've never seen something like this in a seven-game series where Vegas is going to be fucking rocking to the tune of a full boat in their arena, close to a full boat, right? And then the home games in Montreal, what, 2,500 people? How do you quantify home ice advantage when one team has it and one team doesn't? Is it even possible?
You guess is what you do, Sam. That's the reality of it. I think there's just a lot of guesswork when you're modeling sports. And that's one of the limitations that models have just in general. And that's why I always try to put like a range on things whenever I'm talking about games or series or anything in the NHL. But yeah, there's obviously clearly a difference here. And I was actually chatting about this with a buddy this morning who was talking about game one and the price for Vegas against Montreal. And I said to him, I'm not sure I'm accurately quantifying Vegas's home ice advantage. I've been to two playoff games in Vegas before. This is a couple years ago now, but and this is where like a bias starts to creep in. But this isn't just like a standard home ice. You can barely hear the person next to you. Whereas I've been to other rinks. I went to Pittsburgh for the Stanley Cup Finals, and it was like I was basically at a library for one of those games. And I've been to Nashville, which you wouldn't consider to be a huge hockey market, and the games are electric. So like you go all over the place, and these things start to creep into your mind. But it's very tough. It's very, very difficult to do that because, I mean, home ice advantage isn't only built off of the fans in the arena, right? There's other factors that are going to come into effect. Like the travel means something, sleeping in your actual bed means something, but the majority of it is built up off of the fans and the referee bias as well. And when you get into these situations where we just, there's nothing to fall back on. This is unprecedented. We haven't seen this happen in the past. All I can really do is guess. And then basically, you know, I think that's pretty much what everyone in the market is doing right now. And you just got to hope that your educated guess is better than others.
We have to discuss something very important right now. And that is Tortellini the Tortoise. I don't know how the story came to fruition, but I have been following. I actually follow him. He hasn't followed me back yet. That's okay. I probably need to do a little bit more. But Tortellini the Tortoise is actually, I think he's better than a lot of the handicappers on Twitter, for that matter. How did the story start? And give a little bit of the details out for our audience, please.
Yeah, Tortellini is a tortoise that I own. And I was never really a big fan of Tortellini, if I'm being completely honest. Like he's a pet that requires a lot of work and there's not like a lot of payoff. I've had dogs before and I have a dog now where, you know, they're around you a little bit more. So we actually donated him to the local library years ago so that he could just be like an instructional animal there. And the kids would go and feed him lettuce and whatever. And he's lived at the library for years, but then COVID hit and they didn't have people go into the library for work anymore. So they basically called us and said, we don't have anyone to take care of him anymore. You guys want to take him back? I said, sure, we'll take him back. And since then I've kind of like, I don't want to say fallen in love with him, but yeah, it's kind of the right words to use. Like he's great. I take him outside with me in the yard and stuff like that. So he's my pet tortoise. And basically I've been getting like challenges on Twitter for a long time of like, let's do this 1 month handicapping competition or 7 days competition. And I'm not really into that stuff. Like I like to keep my stuff pretty private. I don't want people knowing what I'm betting on just in general. I also don't want to just take on an average random person in some 7 day competition where there's a ton of variance, where basically I'm the only person that has anything to lose in that type of situation. So someone challenged me to some sort of handicapping competition. I said, no, but you can take on one of my pets if you want to. And that's how Ben the Better versus Tortellini was born. And it turned into like a really big thing. Like it surprised me at how large it got. I do NFL periscopes on Sunday mornings throughout the NFL season, where I average a certain number of viewers. And a few of the Tortellini pick segments were actually doing more viewers than I was doing during NFL season. So it actually blew up quite a bit, but we had some fun with it. It turned out to be more work than I had hoped for, because it's like, you got to get the tortoise to eat. You have to, there's a lot of setup that goes into it, but it came down to the wire, and Tortellini, the tortoise, ended up beating Ben the Better, who actually had one of his best weeks in the entire year, still ended up managing to lose to the tortoise.
What's the series price? Ben the Better against the bartender.
Ooh. both of those guys are extreme. Like, I always joke about this just in general, right? Because I've talked about fading the public with you before, Sam, just in general, and how people are very quick to fade others or want to because they're so bad at picking. But the reality is you have to pay a VIG in order to fade that person. It's in the long run, it's you shouldn't be profitable by doing that. But there are some people who just are able to circumvent this theory in general, and they are so bad at picking games that you really have to scratch your head. Like, the theory with Ben the Better for a long time, the gambling Twitter theory, was that this is a professional better posting the opposite of his picks, which isn't true. I mean, it's not. It's just, you know, a random guy posting his picks, but he is so bad. And I think he's got to be the number one fade. Like, I know the bartender is awful, and I see you posting the picks as well, but until proven otherwise, Ben the Better is the number one fade on the planet.
Okay, so Ben the Better minus a quarter. I think that's what you said, kind of, in a roundabout way. I don't know how I can possibly follow that up, though, from last season. The bartender was, let's see, he was 11-24, so just over 30%. I don't know that I can do that again. Now, there is a bartender. All these plays are based on a guy, but I don't know that I can replicate that. And as you know, the sample size is low, but I have to do it again next year. I don't think I can live up to what happened last year where the guy goes 11-24.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good content in general. It's just like a fun thing to follow. I don't think you're doing anyone any harm in posting that information and whatever. But yeah, the variance is very real. Like, I'm sure if I take my last calendar year of bets and I was to break it up by 35 game samples, I would probably find like four or five times, maybe even more than that, where I've gotten 11-24 over a random stretch. And it happens. I mean, I do think that in the long run, you know, if you have the bartender and he gets to like 1,000 pick sample size, I do think he's going to be closer to 50%. That's just what I guess mathematics would tell me. If worst case, the guy is a coin flipper and he should be picking at, as long as he's picking spreads, he should be picking at that rate. But again, there's some people who, like, Ben is at a sample of well over 1,000 and the guy hits it like low 40s percentages. So you got to really ask yourself, are there like outside factors at work? Is this guy truly a mush where he's just so bad at picking things that he's fade material? But it's, I find this stuff really funny because everybody kind of has that one person in their life. For you, it's the bartender. A gambling Twitter has been, I have a personal friend as well who we just joke about whenever he tweets something, even if it's not even a bet on a game, just like an opinion on something, we try to find a bet to fade it. And it kind of has worked out over time. So I find this stuff very amusing.
I want to go back to something you just said, because I think it's very important when somebody like you admits something like you just did. You said there have been stretches, you know, over 1,000 games or so where you're going to have a run like 11-23. A lot of people, though, Rob, they don't have the fucking balls to admit that or discuss that. They gloss over that, and we only see the bright lights. We never see the pit. We never see the bottom. How do you handle a stretch like that? Because for a lot of people, if they go 11-23, they're firing in 5 or 10 more bets. They're doing their parlays. They feel like, well, eventually it's going to regress and eventually I'm going to come back over the top. I imagine your strategy is a lot different than that, but why do you A, admit that, and B, how do you handle a stretch like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind admitting that just in general, because I mean, I live in reality. I think, yeah. Everyone who bets on sports knows that no one is immune to these types of runs. I mean, you obviously get your internet trolls here and there who will call you out for it, which doesn't really bother me at all. I'm making money off betting sports. And if somebody wants to spend their time on the internet just, you know, tweeting at me, I'll gladly mute them. But the reality of the situation is it's very difficult, more difficult than some people would realize. And even as somebody who's, you know, mired in mathematics and stats, and I'm very much aware that I'm going to go on bad runs. When you are in that bad run, it does play a toll on you mentally, or at least it does for me. I shouldn't equate that to everyone who's in these situations, but it hurts your confidence a little bit. For me, what I end up doing is kind of digging very deep into that run and trying to see if there's some sort of trend that I'm noticing. Is it I'm betting exclusively on home teams and maybe my, you know, my home ice factor is too high, or just like kind of really breaking it down as to what were these bets? Did I get unlucky on these bets, or did I, like, am I deserving of this losing streak? And most of the time it comes back to, okay, I just had a bad stretch where I got unlucky. But the times where you missed games and you weren't even close, that's the real tough ones where you start to dig deeper and saying, okay, what am I doing wrong here? So I've made it pretty public of like the mental aspect, I guess, of pro sports betting. And I don't really love sports betting in general. It's just a good way for me to make money. But if I could be making this money in another industry that I really liked, I probably would do that instead, because I think there's definitely these stretches that rattle you to your core. And I can say that personally, and I'm much better at dealing with it now. I have like my methods, and I meditate and I listen to music and I exercise and I feed my tortoise some lettuce, which is very soothing for some reason. But yeah, it's, I guess for, to each their own, it's very different. But for me, I try to really just dig deep into what's caused this run. If it's just bad luck, I'm going to keep going. If it's not, I might take a few days off here or there to try to figure things out, but I'm not looking to chase. I don't vary my bet sizing or anything like that. I think that's the biggest mistake anyone can make, is they end up down and either they stop because they're in an unlucky stretch, but they haven't realized that. They think that they're just going to lose in the long run. So they stop, and then inevitably things would have turned for them. Or they start to chase and start to make bigger bets, saying, oh, I'm due, I'm going to make this back. And then you get into some real problem gaming situations at that point. So a long-winded answer of saying that it still affects me personally whenever this happens. But
shit happens. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
You brought up trolls, and I told you about this. I wanted to get into this. I deal with trolls all the time, and mostly it's result-driven. I go 4-1, you don't hear a word. I go 1-4, I suck, I don't know anything, whatever. But there was a completely out of context plus EV Twitter mob last week, where before the series started with the Lakers and the Suns, I said, here's what's going to happen. The Suns are going to win game one, and then we're all going to bet the Lakers series -110, +100, whatever. Got that right. They won the first game. We took Suns game one, and then we took Lakers series -10. So it goes four games, and it's 2-2, and Davis's status is completely unknown. And the books didn't know what to do with the series price. Some of the books had, you know, Suns -20, some had 30, one book had 50. And I got a lot of Twitter messages from people that were already on Lakers -10 that felt really good about Lakers +130. Or Lakers +120. And they said, what do you think about a unit on the Lakers to win the series? And I go, well, I'm good. I'm already invested at -10. I don't know about Davis. I'm good. But it sounds like you feel strongly about this. Oh, yeah, Lakers are winning the series. So I say, hey, man, if you're looking for a little extra gamble, rather than take the Lakers series, why don't you just take the Lakers in 6 and the Lakers in 7 and just have some fun with it? And the guys are like, oh, okay, yeah, like I can, if they win in 6, I'll make 2 units. If they win in 7, I'll make 2.2 or whatever. I got fucking roasted, man, because then I got the plus EV guys like, you don't know what you're talking about. 2 units at +130 makes you more money. They're tweeting at my bosses. They're tagging my companies like, this guy doesn't know anything. And there were 8 people that I had to mute and block. And it was, again, it's something that's taken so far out of context. I'm aware that 2-6 is greater than 2-5, but that wasn't the point that I was getting at. I was saying, hey, man, look, if you like the series, have some fun, throw a dart on 6 and 7 and just see what happens. But, oh, my God, the pitchforks, man, they came from every direction.
Well, listen, Sam, I'll be honest with you. I can't say that I haven't been part of that pitchfork community at times before. And I still every now and then see something that triggers me to the point where I can't stay out of it just in general. But what I think a lot of people forget about, and this happens in the gambling Twitter community, is they think everyone is doing this professionally, and it's fine to do stuff recreationally and to post picks that are just for fun and things of that nature, where there's like, yeah, maybe they're not positive expected value in the long run, but The majority of people are gambling for entertainment purposes. They're not trying to do it to grind out a living. And I've taken a step back from that in the past. Like, I've seen stuff before of, you know, bet this team in the first half and bet the other side in the full game, which a lot of people will be like, oh, no, you can't do that. I used to see it in baseball. You know, some guy used to post, I'm betting this team in the first five innings, but I'm going to bet the other team in the full game. And he used to just get absolutely roasted whenever that happened in general. But the reality is, over time, I've just learned how much of a cesspool Twitter is overall. And I hate to say it because I do use it every day, but I use it in a much different capacity now, where I'm more so using it for news and just kind of to stay in touch with what's going on. But the reality is there's so much negative commentary in the space. And I've taken a step back and saying, you know, said to myself, I've been guilty of this just as much as everyone else, but it's very hard to be in that space and to take anything seriously because there's no accountability. People are tweeting from aliases. They're creating different accounts. So it makes things seem so much more extreme than they actually are in general. So, I mean, I just take the same approach as you now. I don't even block. I just mute and move on. I hope that they're still tweeting at me to this day and just wasting breath or wasting, I guess, keys, whatever they're doing to typing. But yeah, I mean, it can get real wacky out there if and because of that, it's a culture where like everyone's afraid to make a mistake, which I think are good learning opportunities as well. Like I have a lot of tweets that I'm not proud of in the past, but people jumped on me. I kind of would take a step back and say, okay, you know, I can kind of understand what this person's getting at. I'll maybe either DM them on the side and say, can you explain this a little bit more? And it was a pretty good learning experience for me, but now it's gone to the point where it's more so of, it's way more aggressive than I would say it used to be.
The irony is both bets lost, right? It didn't really matter because the Lakers got knocked out. All of this over a tenth of a unit, mind you. I don't like, and then the whole next day, I'm like, I had six tweets I sent out the next day, multiple replies and responses to every tweet. Yeah, well, you don't know how to do simple math. And I'm like, oh my God, like you guys took this whole thing completely out of context. I think I have 10 accounts blocked and I blocked 8 of them last week. So I usually can handle it. But when you start like tagging my bosses and my companies, it's like, get a fucking life, dude.
I've done the complete opposite for someone before when they tagged my employer, who was the score at the time, under an alias. And I was able to figure out who they were. And I sent them a nice message on the side saying, hey, I know who you are. I know what you do. I know which company you work for. And all of a sudden this person turned into a saint. You know, they loved me. They loved everything I do. And it's hilarious when, because we live behind public images, and the vast majority of Twitter doesn't, like I said, there's just no accountability. So it's funny when things are turned on others who are expecting to remain anonymous, and then you figure out who they are by who they're by what they're tweeting and things of that nature. So I had a pretty good laugh of that a few years ago.
We are, believe it or not, we are 3 months away, less than 3 months actually, from the NFL. I don't know if you've made any positions yet on divisional markets, conference, Super Bowl, win totals. If you have, maybe share one of those. But are there any general, you know, theories or angles you have going into the season, whether it's a buy on team, a sell team? You know, how is the NFL? How are you attacking the NFL in the middle of June, if you even are at this point?
Yeah, I am. I'm pretty invested in a lot of season win totals. I have a few futures here and there just in general, and I like to get my work started early on these. You can actually get down more money than I realized over the course of the summer than a lot of people would say, well, why are you tying up this money, because you know it's going to take 8 months for you to get paid out on it. And I guess it's a matter of opportunity cost, but when you see edges, typically for me, I do like to fire on them. I will say one thing that has really caught me off guard, I guess, over the course of the past couple weeks is I'm very high on the Cleveland Browns this year, just in general, but it seems that I guess everyone is high on the Cleveland Browns. So you're getting a lot of people who are like, you know, I can't wait to fade the Browns next year. They're kind of like the off-season team. And I don't really see anybody talking about like any X's and O's for why the Browns would fail. It's more so that, oh, too many people like them, so they're going to fail. And it kind of just brings me back to last year where this was kind of the off-season with the Tampa Bay Bucks, right? They signed Tom Brady and people are like, oh, you know, Brady's over the hill. This is the team going in with a lot of hype. I'm going to look to fade them. And they end up winning the Super Bowl. And we're only 1 year removed from that. And the kind of the narrative has been spun up that, oh, the Browns have no chance because, you know, they're the offseason team that's getting the most hype, which I don't really agree with. I think this is a team with an amazing offensive and defensive line. If the Bucs taught us anything in last year's Super Bowl, it's that that makes a pretty major impact on the game. I see them as a pretty deep team that could withstand injuries as well. I think they're very well coached. I think the Steelers are on the decline in that division, which makes it a little bit more easier for them. I don't think the Ravens are what they were a couple years ago, although they're still a contender in my opinion. So I'm pretty high on Cleveland. I'm seeing Super Bowl prices still in the, I guess, 15-1, 16-1 range. And I think that's a pretty valuable bet.
I had a scout tell me they have the most talented roster in football, 53 deep.
I honestly, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think about it. Now, obviously, the quarterback position is where there's a concern. And if somebody says, yeah, I don't trust Baker Mayfield, I completely get it because there's been times where he's been erratic in the past. But I think they've built an offense around him where it's very difficult for him to fail in general. They're working to his strengths. They have two really good running backs. And Nick Chubb is just a fantastic back all around. And I don't know. I see a lot of things having to go wrong this year for that team to fail just based off the talent that they have.
Last thing for Rob Pizzola, at Rob Pizzola on Twitter. BetStamp is your newest passion project. You are a partner at BetStamp. It's at BetStamp on Twitter. You guys track, you compare odds. It's tools for people that bet on sports. And you should check it out again, BetStamp, at BetStamp. How did this come on your plate? And give us the elevator pitch on BetStamp, please.
Yeah, so how it came on my plate, I bash Twitter a lot, but I received a DM on Twitter one day, and this is going back over a year now, from who is one of the people who's now the founder of BetStamp, who basically said to me, you know, we have this app that we're working on. It's in beta right now. We'd like to take you to take a look and pick your brain a little bit. I kind of met up with them, and they're Toronto based as well. And I met up with them and they showed me what they had built out so far. And I was like, you know, this is really interesting. Like this is a nice, clean, sleek app. And I've worked for The Score before as their product manager. And I kind of have some experience in that. So I basically said, you know, get this into my hands and let me play around with it. And I noticed that I became pretty much a daily user of it. I was using it for some line shopping. Like there's obviously other line shopping tools and you could pay $500 a month for Don Best. But there was a lot of problems with Don Best at that time. And I just basically became enamored with this thing to the point where I was like, I need to get involved in this project at some point. And timing was never good. And then until recently, it's because I had a lot on my plate. And then eventually I just reached out to the guys and said, I need to be a part of this. And we were able to work something out. But yeah, essentially, it's a great utility for three different reasons. One, for line shopping. I preach line shopping all the time and the importance of getting the best price. But if I can just like bring it back to a real life example, if you go to the grocery store and you see the same product on the shelf, and every one of those is priced at $2, but one is priced at $1.75. You're always going to get the one that's $1.75. And for some reason or another, people don't apply this same logic to sports betting, but it saves you so much in the long run or could win you more in the long run as well. So I'm a big proponent of that. I'm obviously a big proponent of bet tracking, even if it's not public. You learn a lot from tracking your own bets and seeing where you're going wrong with your own bets. And then it adjusting based off of that. So I think it is by far the best bet tracking tool I've ever come across. And this is from someone who does extensive bet tracking themselves. So those two were really big for me. And then the third one, there is a marketplace on BetStamp where you can buy and sell picks. But the beauty of this marketplace instead of anywhere else where people are selling picks is that the records of the people that are selling are actually verified. So the one thing that BetStamp does is if I'm going to go in and lock in a play, it's going to verify that this line actually exists at the sportsbook that I'm locking it in at. So there's no more of a tout releasing -2 on a game where the line has already been moved to -3. It's verified that that's the case. And the user or the person who's buying the picks can at least do their due diligence on someone, go through their extensive record history and say, okay, I actually want to buy this person's picks instead of going to some site, getting, you know, trends from their, you know, this guy's on a 7-0 hot streak, which we all know doesn't mean anything or whatever. So it's kind of a marketplace that really protects the user or the buyer, I should say, from getting scammed, which is something that's important to me as well, because pick buying and selling is always going to exist, whether there's people who like it or not. At the end of the day, it's going to be a big market regardless, especially with regulation happening across North America now. So we've got to do our best to protect the buyer from getting scammed. And that's what the marketplace is all about. So all those things got me excited about it. I still use the app every day. I'm very excited for what's coming forward. So if anyone wants to check it out, you can just download it in the App Store on iPhone or Android, or you can hit up the website as well, which is betstamp.app, APP, which we have launched recently as well. So please do check it out. I mean, I believe in it. I think it is a real utility that will help you win as a sports bettor.
Please follow our guy at Rob Pizzola, P-I-Z-Z-O-L-A. This went longer than I thought, but we also could have gone another 30 minutes. I always appreciate these conversations, and I hope to see you in Vegas at the Piano Bar, maybe sometime, maybe August or September, buddy. Thanks for coming on, always.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
That about does it for Chicken Dinner. Thanks to Rob Pizzola for hopping on the show. We've got two in the hopper tonight, and they both involve Trae Young. We also have the Hab series pending, plus 425. We're going Young over 27.5. Young over 2.5 threes. The juice about minus 130 on the three-point prop. Record check, 139, 135, and 5. We're down 6-7, but I'm feeling pretty good. I still think the Habs have a shot here. They win game two. We'll see what happens. They lose game two. Could be over. Could be all she wrote. But the basketball's been good, and we got a couple more rounds to go in the NBA playoffs. Cash some tickets. Make some money. We'll talk to you Friday right here on Chicken Dinner.